Metcast, Monday, December 7th, 2015. Hey, MechGeeks, it's time for your Metcast, the show for MechGeeks by MechGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the Maccast. Well, looking over the show notes today, we have quite a number of things to talk about. A lot of new stuff on the horizon, or at least rumors of new stuff. Is that what we talk about most of the time? What's coming next? And then when we finally get it, we talk about that for maybe a week or two, and then it's on to the next thing. It always seems like we're chasing the next big thing from Apple. And this week is no exception. We've got rumors of new MacBook Airs. Going to dive into that for a little bit. Some more updated information actually on iPad Pro processors as well. And then we're going to move on to maybe what's going to happen with the next generation iPhones, along with new Apple TVs in the works already? Yeah, well, maybe. We're going to talk about that. And then we're going to get to a lot of your questions. This episode is going to be a little heavier on the question and answer side of things. Got a lot of great questions surrounding iCloud, specifically family sharing and what to do about iCloud storage and managing that. And then I'm going to get into a little troubleshooting help using some pretty advanced tools, but something you don't need to be afraid of. And we're going to talk about that in a little bit. And then I have a question about different kinds of NAS solutions, network attached storage. And that should round out this episode. So it should be a lot of fun. And let's just jump right into our first story. And that is rumors of MacBook Air updates. Now, this is coming from two muddy sources that are being used to speculate that Apple plans to update the MacBook Air lineup sometime around WWDC. That would be June of 2016. The sources are the Taiwanese publication Economic Daily News, and they say it's their supply chain folks telling them that Apple is working on updates to the MacBook Air. And we know the supply chain is Tim Cook's favorite place to get to have rumors come from, right? Now, he's famously said that we should not trust any rumors coming out of the supply chain, but we're going to talk about them anyway, right? Of course, specific details are sparse, and the Economic Daily News and their sources are playing it safe by keeping their predictions of the new models in the they will be thinner, lighter, and faster realm. Because, you know, why go out on a limb and give any information that might not be obvious? Yeah, really, there's not a lot here, although there are a few little details. They say that in the supply chain, Apple is currently sourcing some new battery packs, cooling modules, panels, and also looking at a redesigned case for this new MacBook model. And while they're quickly jumping to assume that this is a MacBook Air update, a lot of the information is a little bit confusing in my mind. And as Apple Insider points out, the MacBook Pro lineup is also probably due for an update or a refresh, though arguably the MacBook Air is longer in the tooth. It hasn't really been revamped since 2010. And so I think the MacBook Air has a different fate than getting updated, but more on that in a minute. I also think timing-wise, if you're launching a new MacBook series notebook around WWDC, you want to probably appeal to developers and your pro customers. Another thing about this rumor is it states that Apple is possibly also working on a 15-inch design for an updated MacBook Air and might be considering killing off the 11-inch model altogether. The reason they cite for that is the 12-inch iPad Pro, which is something I also find a little bit confusing because I think the thinking behind that is flawed. In my opinion, Apple really sees the iPad Pro and the MacBook platforms as wholly separate things. And yes, they acknowledge that there's some cannibalization with the iPad cutting into MacBook sales, but a MacBook customer still is very different than an iPad Pro customer and vice versa. I think you're going to have one or the other or maybe both, but there's not a lot of crossover there. So it doesn't seem to make sense to me to kill one because of the other. So just speculating on this speculation a little bit, it seems to me that it would be more likely that Apple plans a redesign and revamp of the MacBook Pro lineup, and they would use styling cues and engineering choices like USB-C from the MacBook lineup. And again, this is just my personal speculation on this rumor. They are, I think they're more likely on the MacBook Air side of things to kill the lineup entirely, because now there's a lot of overlap between the MacBook, the Air, and the MacBook Pros. And especially if you take the MacBook Pro, you redesign it, you make it thinner and lighter, it's going to fall even more into that region of the MacBook Air. One of the big differences between the MacBook Pro lineup and the MacBook Air lineup right now is the processor, using the Intel mobile processors versus the notebook class processors. So, on paper, the MacBook Air lineup currently has a little more robust power in the CPUs, but if Apple can bring the MacBook Pro lineup into the same size and form factor range of a MacBook Air, I don't think they're going to actually need that MacBook Air lineup anymore. And I think they could also possibly add a 13-inch model to the MacBook lineup and really round out the entire thing, simplify the product lineup. And as the MacBook Pro gets thinner and more powerful, it seems to me like there'd just be a lot less room in the lineup for an Air. And I think ultimately what's great about that is it would get Apple back to what I call the four square product matrix, or I actually think Steve Jobs called it that at one point, where you have consumer notebook, pro notebook, consumer Mac, and pro Mac, although the consumer pro Mac side of things is still a little bit muddy. But imagine if they go to just simply MacBooks and MacBook Pros on the notebook lineup, that fills out those two quadrants of that four square pretty nicely on the notebook side. And then on the Mac side, you would have the iMac presumably being the consumer offering and the Mac Pro being the pro offering, although the 27-inch Retina iMac also really appeals to pro users. So I'm not sure what would fill out that pro quadrant. Like I said, it's a little bit mixed up at this point, but I think that would be a much better lineup. And, I think the Air is more on the way out than getting upgraded. This week, we also got some new information surrounding the iPad Pro's processor. A lot of people very interested in that, because in a lot of the teardowns and the analysis, it seems like this is a pretty beefy CPU and, more importantly, GPU from Apple. And this time around, a lot of the analysis focused on the graphics processing unit. This came from Chipworks. They're the guys who take it and put it under microscopes and x-rays and things like that. And the information was released through the Motley Fool, and it revealed details about the iPad Pro's A9X processor, including the fact that it has a 12-cluster GPU. That effectively doubles the GPU capabilities of the iPhone 6S's A9 processor. And interestingly enough, the A9X also doesn't have the on-die 8GB memory cache that is in the iPhone 6S's A9 processor. And speculation there is that the A9X doesn't need it because its memory interface is twice as wide, so it doesn't need that extra caching capabilities. The extra GPU cluster also means that the A9X is about twice as large in physical size as its non-X sister chip. That's to make room for those extra clusters. And the breakdown also showed that the A9X has two CPU cores and double the RAM, which was expected, 4GB versus 2GB found in the iPhone 6S and the iPad Air 2. So some amazing technology in that new A9X processor, and actually all of Apple's A-series processors. They did a lot of work in acquiring some pretty smart chip designers and working with their partners to build out these things. We're even getting speculation now, as you may know, that Apple might look at using their own designed processors in future Macs. That buzz has been going on for a while, but I think we haven't really thought about it seriously till we started seeing this A9X processor and some of the technology Apple has been able to cram into the iPad Pro. And it does cause you to think about what could they do if they built chips for their Macs. I don't think they're going to be exactly the same. Again, I think Apple has a very distinct strategy between tablets and desktops, but, Intel should be a little bit worried at this point. Now, even for all its great buzz and technology, the question still remains if the iPad Pro can counteract Apple's slowing tablet sales. Tablet sales are just slowing in general. We got latest numbers from IDC, and they predict that by the end of 2015, worldwide tablet shipments will reach about 211.3 million units. And while that sounds a lot, that's actually down 8.1% from 2014. Still, they think pretty positively, about the future of the tablet market. They think that detachables, which are things like the iPad Pro and the Microsoft Surface tablet, basically tablets that have keyboards that can be attached, that is going to represent a growth area for the tablet market. And they say they see a trend of consumers looking to do more on tablets that's kind of fueling that, moving from just consuming content on the devices to more productivity-based usage. And I would tend to agree with that. I think more of us are looking to our tablets to be able to do more things on them. And new designs and new technologies like the iPad Pro are going to enable that. And a lot of that growth is also being driven by enterprise and prosumer needs. So there's a lot of people that don't want to just watch movies and consume content and surf the web on a tablet. They want to be able to produce things like music and art. I think those are logical extensions. A lot of photographers are looking seriously at the iPad Pro, although storage continues to be one of those things that we're going to struggle with in a lot of those markets. But as more and more cloud solutions come into play and things get better there, that's changing. That dynamic's changing. And I think IDC is responding to that, thinking, okay, here's a new category. Now, still, that growth is being predicted, I think, for just one small segment of the tablet market. So it remains to be seen if it's actually going to have any impact on the declining unit shipment numbers overall. I think tablets people are happy with. They keep them for, you know, a number of years. They're falling in line a lot with the same, I think, upgrade cycle as notebooks. And since in many cases, consumers are using them to replace notebooks, it seems very natural, the numbers that we're actually seeing. It's surprising how many people are talking about it as if it were a shocking thing. And I don't think it's something that's shocking to Apple. If you listen to Tim Cook when they have Apple's quarterly results calls, they seem to be pretty aware of the fact that there was going to be some cannibalization. People are going to be transitioning from tablets, or from notebooks rather, to tablets, and that's going to change the dynamic of Apple's product mix. I think it's also why we see them making a lot of the focus of things moving forward in the iOS space and the tablet space, much to the chagrin sometimes of us as Mac owners and Mac users, but it starts to make sense when you look at the bigger picture. And I think as far as tablet sales go, at least in Apple's case, the fact that the iPad Pro has a higher average selling price is going to have a more positive impact for Apple than other customers. So they'll see this rise in this new, what IDC is calling, detachable segment, and it's going to be a highly profitable area. So it will, at least in the short term, I think, stem the declining revenue impact that slowing iPad sales have had on Apple, and it will be a net positive. How long that will last for, that remains to be seen. I guess it depends on how much this market segment grows and how many more consumer, or rather enterprise and prosumer users, start looking at tablets as serious production machines. But I think the iPad Pro is a good start toward that end. I think most people understand that Apple is usually a year, if not years, ahead on the development and research for their next generation devices. So this next report out of China from Weibo didn't really surprise me, but G4Games is reporting that a source says Apple is exploring at least five different versions of an iPhone 7. So typically in those non-S years, Apple looks to do major changes to the iPhone lineup. And it's not surprising to me that they'd really be looking at and investing in different kinds of designs, different kinds of technology features and things like that. But what I do think is somewhat interesting about this report is they did give a list of technologies that Apple might be playing around with, or likely is playing around with. Some are surprising, some not as much, some we have kind of heard about already. One thing mentioned is a new type of USB-C connector that would support wireless charging. I'm not sure how that factors in, but also headsets. You may remember from I think we talked about this in the last episode, that Apple is potentially looking to use a lightning connector for headphones and get rid of the headphone jack in the next generation iPhone. This one's a little bit different as it references a USB-C type connector. I'm not sure why Apple just wouldn't use a USB-C connector. Maybe there's some eliminating technologies in there. But it would make sense that if Apple is going to dump the headphone jack and go with just wireless solution like Bluetooth, and then also give the option to connect headphones via the same charging, you know, what is currently the Lightning charging port, that they might consider putting in wireless charging, and then that single port doesn't have to be used for charging anymore. You can use that for plugging in your accessories or your headphones. So it would make a lot more sense. Another technology they say Apple is exploring is multi-force touch. I'm not really sure exactly what that means, and they didn't really describe it in the report. Maybe more levels beyond just the peak and pop, although I would imagine it'd be hard in a UI perspective to kind of get multi-levels. And anybody who's maybe used the 3D touch technology in the new MacBook or the Magic Trackpad, you probably know it's kind of hard to get those multi-levels. Apple kind of has that concept of, in some apps, you can continue to push harder and harder and harder, and then different actions will happen. It's hard to hit those middle tiers. So how that would actually work in an iPhone, I don't know, but it looks like it's a technology that Apple is at least exploring. Another thing mentioned is a dual camera configuration. I would assume this would have something to do with doing like 3D or augmented or enhanced images. Apple has acquired a number of technology companies in the realm of VR, augmented reality, visual processing, and things like that. And so we could have new gesture-based technologies. We could have technologies with the camera being allowed to add more depth and do more exposures. And there's all kinds of creative things you could do if you had a multi-lens system in your device. Also, adaptive focusing, things like that, where you can get multiple focus points and change things after you get the image back. So some interesting technologies there. Also, Touch ID integrated into the display itself. We've heard about that for a while, and that sounds like something Apple would want to do. That usually gets coupled along with the rumor that Apple's looking to get rid of the home button. I hope that never happens. I personally really like the home button. I think it's nice to have a physical, clickable thing that you can touch, and I think it's good for accessibility reasons as well, although Apple's often gotten creative at making accessibility functions work on a touchscreen. I mean, really, they pioneered that technology with the original iPhone, so it might not be so bad to have the Touch ID integrated right into the display. And then the last thing in the rumor, and I don't know where this factors in because I'm not big into display technologies, but they do say that Apple might be looking at AMOLED displays for the iPhone 7. Now, any one of these technologies, I think, could be amazing in the next iPhone. But again, just because Apple is playing around with this stuff and exploring it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be something or anything that we're going to see in the next generation production device. It's just something that Apple is looking at this point, and we're getting these rumors out of the supply chain. A lot of these rumors, as I mentioned before, were also rumored in the past and have been over several generations of iPhones, and we still haven't seen some of them see the light of day. I mean, again, that integrated Touch ID in the display, that was something that was rumored for the iPhone 6S, and of course, that was something that didn't happen. Now, one thing is for sure is that Apple will likely continue to produce a large plus size iPhone. The question in my mind is, would they even consider going bigger? Consumer Intelligence Research Partners did a study, and they found out that customers are opting more and more for the larger screen iPhone. In their report, they say in the first 30 days of sales, 37% of customers chose to buy the larger iPhone 6S Plus, and that's compared to the first 30 days of iPhone 6 sales, when just 25% of customers opted for the larger size screen. Now, part of what might be going on there is the large screen iPhone could be wooing over Android switchers, people who didn't have an iPhone choice before for a larger screen model. They say that 26% of iPhone buyers this time around are switching from Android. That's compared to 12% of switchers when Apple released the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody really likes a larger screen. Some consumers apparently still prefer smaller screens. A Piper Jaffray poll of 1,077 U.S. consumers determined that about 20.3% said that they would prefer a 4-inch handset. And that's certainly a stat that I have seen mirrored from you. I get a lot of feedback in the MacCast email about people who want a 4-inch choice in an iPhone device. As far as the other sizes go, 31.2% said they like a 4.7-inch, and 27.2% said 5.5-inch, and then finally 21.2% fell into the other category, and I guess that means they want either something bigger than 5.5 inches or smaller than 4 inches. And believe it or not, I have heard from people on both sides of that camp. They say, I want an even bigger iPhone, something more like a Galaxy Note in that 5.7, approaching that 6-inch, that 6-inch size. And also I've heard people say, hey, no, I want actually like the old days, that 3.5-inch screen was the perfect size for me. So just goes to show that Apple probably should have a wide-ranging lineup, and I guess that means the 20% is enough for Apple to consider a 4-inch model, because we're continuing to hear rumors that Apple is planning a 4-inch phone, although it's sounding like now it's going to be called an iPhone 6C or maybe something else. More on that in a second. But supply chain sources with Foxconn are allegedly saying that an iPhone 6C is on track for a February 2016 debut. It's going to be a aluminum enclosure, so Apple would move from the plastic enclosure of the iPhone 5C to a metal case, although it will retain the colors in the form of anodized colors. So not just the space gray, silver, and gold that we're used to with the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus lineup, but continuing the playful color scheme. They didn't give details on specifically what colors, and it's sounding like there's going to be a limited choice, maybe still 3 or 4, something like that, but sticking with the colors for the 4-inch lineup. It would have Touch ID, but no Force Touch. That's a rumor we've heard before. And Apple is reportedly targeting a price point of about $400 to $500 US. So with subsidies, I think that falls in the $99 to $199 range, which is kind of the entry level for the iPhone. And a lot of these rumors are being mirrored by a pretty reliable source. Ming-Chi Kuo is chimed in on some of the specs as well and said, yes, there's a 4-inch model coming. He predicts that it's going to have an A9 processor and support for Apple Pay. Also, he says it'll have identical camera specifications to the current iPhone 5S, although his timing on when it will really be released is a little bit later than the February timeframe. He says it'll ship in early 2016, but potentially around the March-April timeframe. And then there was one other odd rumor related to this new 4-inch iPhone this week, and that was the claim that Apple would call it the iPhone 7C, not the 6C. And the thought process there is that because Apple's expected to update the lineup this year with the iPhone 7, they wanted it to be in the same naming range. And that same rumor was also predicting that we won't see the iPhone 7C in the first quarter, but it would come out in September with a full revamped lineup of iPhones. So you would have iPhone 7C, iPhone 7, and iPhone 7 Plus. But it's looking at this point, regardless of when it's released or what the actual name turns out to be, we are very likely getting a 4-inch version of an iPhone updated sometime in 2016. And then I just had one other side bit of iPhone news, and I'm throwing it in here because I didn't really have any other place to get it to fit. Some potentially bad news for AT&T customers in the States who have held on to their grandfathered unlimited data plans. AT&T is finally upping the cost of those data plans. They're not taking them away, but they're going to move the pricing, they say, from $30 US per month to $35 a month, and that should happen in February. Now, some people are getting a little bit upset about this, but to be fair, AT&T has not increased prices on those plans in 7 years. And while they were doing some pretty severe data throttling once you got over 5 gigabytes, they changed that a couple months ago, and the current cap is at 22 gigabytes. So for $35 a month, you have basically unlimited usage up to 22 gigabytes of data. And then beyond that, you'll get data throttled. But I can't even imagine using 22 gigabytes of data. I'm on a 6 gigabyte family share plan, and we don't even go over that amount. And I'm, you know, as you might expect, a pretty heavy iPhone data user. I use it for tethering and all the other things. So I think that's plenty of data. And some people have speculated that this is AT&T's way of kind of forcing some of those grandfathered people off of those data plans. I don't know if that's really the case. I think they're just looking at, you know, it's been 7 years, there's been inflation, there's been things that change. We need to recoup some of that cost on those older plans that people have been holding on to for 7 years. And the other thing is, I don't even know how much unlimited data plans are needed anymore with the current way things are set up. And we could probably have a debate on that. If you want to chime in and send me some feedback, maccast@gmail.com, especially if you've been holding on to that grandfather data plan. I can just give you my experience. I held on to mine for a really long time, and then ultimately decided that I wanted to be able to do data tethering. I wanted to get rid of my cellular iPad and just go with a Wi-Fi iPad. Never looked back, and it's been a great choice because I pay less money in total, and I have the added convenience of being able to do the data throttling. So getting rid of my unlimited data plan, I thought I might regret, but I never did. But again, that was just my experience, and everybody's kind of situation is different, and there is no sort of one data plan fits all solution or one phone plan fits all solution, which is, I think, a good reason why we have choices. And it's good to see at least AT&T isn't forcing the hand and completely taking the unlimited options away from those people who have it. If you recently bought a new Apple TV, this next story, it may get your dander up a little bit. Let's just say that, at least if rumors from DigiTimes are to be believed. Now, they are often right and often wrong, but the Chinese site says that Apple is getting ready to test production of the next fifth generation Apple TV in, get this, early 2016. Yeah, within just the next couple months. As a matter of fact, they're thinking that they're going to start test production at the end of this month. And so the release date time frame is looking to be less than 6 months after the launch of the fourth generation Apple TV, which Apple just put out in October. I just got mine, and they're already getting ready to put out a new one. Now, the details on any new features are vague at best, with DigiTimes simply stating that Apple will, quote, drastically improve the hardware performance and, quote, add new functions. Well, duh, yeah. I would hope they're going to improve the hardware and performance and add new functions. That's pretty much par for the course for any piece of technology, right? We're not going to make it slower and work worse and look uglier. That's not going to happen. Well, I guess maybe sometimes that can happen. Bigger point here, though, is that if true, Apple would be launching an Apple TV just 6 months after the last one. And that is certainly atypical for Apple, and even more odd considering the fact that it took them 3 years to update the current model. Still, DigiTimes is claiming that Apple will enter trial production before the end of this month and has a volume manufacturing date planned for sometime in the first quarter of 2016. And why they would be doing that, I don't know. Maybe because they're trying to get in line with some of their competitors who are constantly revving these things. Maybe it's because they consider the fact that it has a lower price point, that $149 to $199 price range, a sign that customers will more readily upgrade and buy new Apple TVs. I know I certainly would probably be suckered into buying a new one, even if it came out in 6 months, although I might not be really happy about it. And the other thing that's going on is it's still believed that Apple does want to do a true paid streaming TV service, and it could be possible that as that gets ready, they want to launch some new hardware right alongside that. And maybe the intention is to take the current fourth generation Apple TV, drop its pricing down to that sub $99, $79 price point to open up the platform to more new customers to support the streaming TV service. But I still think some current Apple TV customers are going to be miffed if this is the approach that Apple takes. But that's what we're hearing right now. A couple other related Apple TV stories this week. Twitter says they want to help with the Apple TV's convoluted on-screen keyboard and password entry issues. They opened up their sign-on, single sign-on digits service to tvOS developers. So now developers can use the API and service in their Apple TV applications to basically display an on-screen code that then tells you to go to a website on a Mac or another device, digits.com/Apple TV, and then you type in that number, and once verified against your, I would assume, Twitter account, which you're signed into, it would automatically log you into the application on your Apple TV. To me, it looks like it works very much like the verify your cable subscription scheme for a lot of the entertainment channels that you can get on the Apple TV. If you've gone through that process, you have a pretty good idea of how this digits thing works, right? You get the on-screen code, you go to a certain website, you enter that in once you've logged into your account on the website, and then it could authenticate you through or pass that authentication through to the app on the Apple TV. So that could help. Ultimately, though, I really hope that Apple either updates their remote app or just simply adds support for Bluetooth keyboards on the Apple TV, and I think that would be problem solved. And you wouldn't have to necessarily give up your login information or go with a single sign-on through a third-party service, something that I think Apple ultimately doesn't want. And then the last thing that's not really Apple TV related, but I just didn't have any other place to put this little story, is Apple Music and iTunes Match are getting their track limit updated. If you used either of the matching services, either through iTunes Match or Apple Music, you have a huge library of music that isn't available in iTunes, you may have hit the 24,000 track, or 25,000 rather, track limit. Well, back in June, Eddie Q and Apple said they were working on upping that limit, and he has now confirmed via Twitter that they're rolling out a new limit, which is 100,000 tracks. Again, the limit only applies to tracks that are not matched and, you know, with ones that are in Apple's iTunes libraries. So I would think that 100,000 non-matched tracks should be good enough for even people with large eclectic music collections. But you have surprised me before. I've received emails from people. I was surprised, actually, when people said they hit the 25,000 track limit. Maybe it's just because I don't have that much music, but apparently a lot of people have huge, huge music collections, and if you're into classical or jazz or some more eclectic music genres, then maybe you will hit that limit. But now, hopefully you won't, and it has been updated. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Now, I want to get into some questions surrounding iCloud and iCloud services. This week, Josh wrote in to say that his wife has finally expressed interest in getting an iPhone, which is great for you, Josh. Congratulations. But he mentioned now he's in a situation where he might want to use iCloud family sharing, and he had some questions. And Josh, I'm going to try my best to answer these. I use family sharing, although I'm a relatively new to it myself. I've been playing around with it, doing a little bit of research. And I think your timing is also good, because I think it's not just you who are looking at family sharing. A number of you are probably going to be adding some new devices and iPhones to your family's iOS device collection this holiday season, and maybe you are curious about family sharing as well. So let's start with your specific questions, Josh, and then I'll just mention a few other things that I've discovered through my own experience. So one of Josh's first questions was, should he use just one iCloud account or set up multiple? And Josh, this one's pretty easy, because if you're going to use family sharing and iCloud, you want each person to have their own iCloud account. I think actually family sharing requires it. So your wife is going to have an iCloud account, and you are going to have an iCloud account, and then you'll set her account up under yours, under the family share thing. And if you have kids, same kind of scenario. And that one iCloud account will be used for things like your iCloud email, your contacts, your calendar, your iCloud photos, and you're going to want each family member to be able to sync those things and have access to their own stuff. If you had just one iCloud account, you'd be sharing an iCloud email, which could get a little bit weird. So you really want separate iCloud accounts. And you could use that those separate iCloud accounts for iTunes purchases and for Apple Music, Or you could set up another just iTunes account that you use for that stuff. And there's pluses and minuses to both of those things. But more and more, I think if you're using family sharing, you want to have everybody have their own account, even for iTunes purchases. And we're going to talk about that in a little bit, because you had a question related to that. But remember, an iCloud account and an iTunes account can be the same, but they could also be separate. I just want to throw that out there. And again, there's pluses and minuses that I'll try to explain as we go along here. But your next question, Josh, was, can purchased apps be shared, or does each individual have to buy them separately? And if you each use your own iCloud account in iTunes, then the apps are purchased separately, but everybody in the family share still has access to them. So all the family accounts will use the same credit card. It's the one attached to the master account when they're making purchases. And this is one of those areas where you might decide, well, then I want to use separate iTunes accounts because I want my wife to use her credit card and I want to use my credit card. And you can't really have that. The problem there, if you go down that route, though, is you can't necessarily share those purchases very easily. So by having one family account with one master credit card tied to iTunes and everybody purchasing off that one card, there is the ability to share that purchases through the family thing. You just go into the purchase section and then you can see everybody's account and you can drill into another user's account, see what apps they purchased, and you can add those to or download those to your device. It's pretty easy and straightforward and works pretty well. If you have the situation where you're like, well, I don't want my wife's purchases on my credit card, we use separate credit cards. One creative way around that is to, instead of using credit cards on iTunes, use your credit card, go out and buy iTunes gift cards. And this has the added advantage of oftentimes you can get iTunes gift cards on discount. So you can get, you know, like $100 worth of iTunes gift cards, say at Costco, for $80, 20% off. So you're actually saving money. And then just give each person an iTunes gift card and they can load that into their account and redeem that, you know, use that to make purchases. And those are kept separately. Those amounts are kept separately. So each family member could use that amount. And then you just keep recharging that or keep putting in new iTunes gift cards. And that way you can use whatever credit card you'd like to buy the iTunes gift cards, or each person could buy their own gift cards, however you want to work that out. So that's a creative solution to kind of getting around that limitation. The other nice advantage of having everybody in the family under the one account is that for any child accounts, you can enable the ask to buy option. So they won't be able to actually go directly once that's turned on in and just buy stuff. But what they can do is they can check a little button, say, hey, I want to buy this app. And then each parent gets a notification, or I guess the master account gets a notification via iMessage and says, hey, I think it's via iMessage. It might just be by an alert, an iTunes alert. But regardless, you get a little pop-up and it says, hey, your kid would like to buy this application. Do you approve it or not approve it? And you can simply approve it. And I think it works the same way for in-app purchases. Now, there are only a couple of exceptions to sharing the purchases and under a family share account. And those are in-app purchases and subscriptions. Those are per account. So if you buy an in-app purchase, that will have, within an application, that'll have to be purchased separately for each member of the family, and then audiobooks as well. So if the in-app purchase thing is a big deal to you, that's another reason to maybe continue to share a single iTunes account. And I think there's some creative ways to get around this stuff. I just haven't really had a chance to explore or test them out for myself, but people have told me about various things, the ability to, even if somebody has bought an app in a separate account, I think you can log in, although Apple has some restrictions on that. So I don't want to give out that advice without doing a little more research, but you might want to do some of that on your own as well and figure out, you know, if I use separate iTunes accounts, what are my limitations and what kind of hoops am I going to have to jump through if my wife and I want to share the same application, but it was purchased under separate iTunes accounts. And then I think your last question, Josh, was related to how iTunes content and Apple Music works. You know, how does sharing work for iTunes content and Apple Music? That's similar to applications. Purchases and shared things in iTunes are shared just like apps. So if your wife buys some music, you can go under her account, find that music, and download it. for Apple Music, Apple offers specifically a family account. So a single Apple Music user account is $9.99 a month. For $14.99 a month, you can get a family plan to cover everybody that's within your family. And I use that. That works very well. And that's a good option. The only thing that can't be shared in terms of music or Apple Music and iTunes is an iTunes Music Match account. That cannot be shared. That's $25 a year for each member of the family. And there is no family option for that. There is no discount. And so I think that covers most of your questions, Josh, but I wanted to point out a couple of other things related to family sharing. Actually, you also did ask a little bit about sharing calendars and contacts and reminders and how does that stuff work. Once you set up a family share account, there are some special family calendars and reminder things set up. So there's a family item and reminders that's put together, and all members of your iCloud family can put stuff into that to-do list. Same thing for the calendar. It sets up a family calendar, and you can share that. Now, if you want to limit calendars or reminders to specific members within a family, you can still use the built-in sharing features of the calendar and reminders app that have always existed, where you simply invite anybody with an iCloud account. So because each family member does have an iCloud.com email address, you can simply set up a new calendar. Say if you just wanted you and your wife to have one and the kids and everybody else to have a separate one, you could set up a calendar, invite your wife to that, and you could share just between the two of you, and all of that stuff would sync. As far as I know, there is no iCloud sharing options for contacts or notes. A lot of people ask very frequently, hey, how can I have a shared address book that my wife and I share? And I don't know of any really easy solution for doing that. If anybody happens to know, shoot us an email or an audio comment and let us know about that, because I do get asked about that one a lot. And then another thing I think you asked about, Josh, was restrictions for any child accounts. You know, can family sharing, does that offer any benefits of kind of locking down or limiting what kids have access to? And really, beyond the ask to buy option for when you're doing purchases, there aren't really any restrictions directly related to family plans, but you still can control all of that stuff with the parental controls that are built into Mac and iOS. So you can limit things like the ratings on certain kinds of content, or you can block content in the iBook store and all those sorts of things through the parental controls. And that works really well. So, you know, if you've limited your kids and you say they can only see G and PG movies, even when they go into the purchase section within the family share, if you've bought something on your account and they're trying to, you know, find a movie, they're not going to be able to see any of that content, R-rated movies or PG-13 movies. They just simply won't even show up in their account. They won't show up in the video application for purchase content, all of those sorts of things. So the parental controls work very well for that. And then I just wanted to mention a couple other things. A cool feature that I really enjoy in the family iCloud account is that once you have everybody registered and all their devices registered, they all show up in your Find My iPhone. So my kids and my wife are constantly asking me, hey, can you send it, you know, the ping to my iPhone? I can't find it in the house. And I can just go in under my account now and find all that stuff. When we had separate iCloud accounts, I'd have to log out of my Find My iPhone and log into theirs. But once they're all in that family pool, you can just see everybody's device from your main account. And that's really, really handy. And then one critical thing I think to know about that's not shared in a family plan is iCloud storage. So each account, you know, when you sign up for a free iCloud account, is going to get its 5 gigabytes. But if you upgrade, say, your master account, like I did an upgrade to the, when I think it's 200 gigabytes a month plan, so that I could do iCloud photo sharing, that storage is just available for my account. And my daughter wanted to be able to do more backups, or was using up all of her 5 gigabytes for her iPhone backups. So I recently upgraded her to the 50 gig plan, and that was a separate purchase. So each one of those does need to be purchased separately. And your iCloud photo libraries and storage, all of that stuff, iCloud, you know, documents and things like that, those are all also kept separate and are not shared. So just a few other things to note if you're looking at the family share plans. But I think initially Apple had some struggles. You may have heard the episode I did with David Sparks where he had tried out family sharing and had to roll back from it. If you've heard more recent episodes that I've had with him, they're back on it. Apple has cleaned up and fixed a lot of the problems surrounding family share accounts. And I think they're a great option. If you have a number of members of your family and you're all in the same sort of pool of wanting to, you know, share data, especially your purchased content and things like that, I think it's a great way to go and worth looking into. And I welcome any other feedback for anybody who's been using it. Like I said, I've been using it briefly. I'm not an expert user, but the more I use it, the more I seem to like it. Eshan also wrote me with an iCloud question, and I guess this is something that could come up if you start getting into the family sharing stuff or just if you've been using iCloud for any amount of time. And he's asking about storage. Specifically in his instance, he was on an iPhone, used iCloud storage for a while, switched over to Android, and now is looking to come back. He's going to get a new iPhone and he wants to get back into iCloud. But from his first experience, he had a bunch of stuff that was uploaded into his iCloud account, into his iCloud storage, and is asking, you know, what about cleaning that stuff out? I want to get that out of there so that when I have my new phone, I can just use the iCloud and I don't have this legacy stuff that I have from before I switched over to Android. And so he asked me a few questions. He said, one, is there any way for me to download all of the stuff that's in my iCloud account onto a backup drive and clear out my iCloud account so that when I get my new iPhone, I have all my storage there and available for me? Basically, archive what's already in your iCloud account. And he says, I think the biggest thing taking up space there is pictures, and I want to keep those pictures, but I still want to clear out that space. And so, Eshan, the short answer is yes, you certainly can do that. How you actually do it is really going to depend on where the data is and how you were using iCloud the first time around. Now, if it's mostly just your photos, I'm assuming you're talking about the photo stream and maybe photo shares. I'm not sure how long ago you had your iPhone, if iCloud Photo Library was a thing. But I mean, if you were using iCloud Photo Library, that requires that all of your photos already be locally stored on some Mac, right? You have one library that's the system library that gets uploaded to iCloud Photo Library. So you just have to back that up and you could just simply turn off iCloud Photo Library. And then I think in 30 days, any of the iCloud Photo Library photos delete out of the iCloud account. Now, if you're talking about Photo Stream, that's the feature where anything in your camera roll up to 1,000 photos, I think it is, gets stored and automatically pushed into the cloud. That is something also you could open up the Photos application, turn on Photo Stream, and have it automatically pull those in. You can grab those photos from the Photo Stream and then back those up or export them out of the Photos application. So you could back those up that way. And the same kind of thing goes for photo shares. Just go into the photo share albums and grab the pictures, export them off, and save them. And then once you have them local on your Mac, you could put them onto a backup drive or put them onto disks, do whatever you want to do with them. Manually export them, back up your entire photos library is another way to go, and you just have a copy of that stuff. And then you would be free to kind of clear out your iCloud account. And again, you can do that in a number of different ways, simply turning off the services, you know, turn off photo streaming and turn off any of the shares, and that stuff's going to naturally get expunged and deleted over time. As far as documents, if you were using documents within various applications, I think the easiest way to back that stuff up is you can access it through the sidebar in your Mac. You just turn on iCloud documents and you can go in there and simply drag and drop those off and clear those off. And you can move them to the trash if you want to delete them. Just manage them like you would any other file that's on your Mac. And then for synced calendars and contacts, those kinds of things, you're going to have to open up the calendar application or the contacts application, let those sync up, and then you certainly can, within each one of those applications, export that data into an archive and back that up that way, and then go into the individual applications and start removing or deleting any old data that you don't want in there, and that's naturally going to sync across your iCloud account and remove itself. So it's kind of a manual process, but you certainly can do it. There's no kind of way, if, you know, I think sometimes people think about some of the Google tools and things like that where you can just go to one place and say, hey, I want you to export this giant package of everything. iCloud really doesn't have that kind of option or functionality that I'm aware of. There could be some third-party tools out there. And if you know of one of those tools, send us an email and we will try and share that with the community on a future episode. And then once all that was cleaned out, Eshan, I think your other question was, on a go-forward basis, what's the best effective way to manage my iCloud storage? Are there any specific tips or tricks that I would recommend? And one of the examples you gave was this confusion over photo streams and what's in your camera roll and what gets backed up to iCloud. And I'll just say there isn't really much you need to do beyond just configuring the services that you want to use. And what gets backed up into iCloud, you can control those things through the iCloud settings. So if you're not going to use calendar syncing, don't turn that feature on, and that data is not going to be stored up in the iCloud, up in iCloud. Or if you don't have any plans to use iCloud Photo Library, you obviously don't have to turn that on. You can use Photo Stream versus iCloud Photo Library. And just so you know, the difference between Photo Stream and your camera roll, Photo Stream takes anything that's in your camera roll and automatically syncs that across iCloud and across your devices. But it doesn't, you know, do away with what's in the camera roll on each individual device. And as far as what gets backed up into iCloud, that would be stuff in your camera roll. Photo streams aren't really considered technically backups. It's more just a stream of data, and they don't count against your data storage anyway in iCloud. It's a separate amount of storage that you get for free. So you don't really have to worry about photo streams. And if you're using iCloud Photo Library, it's kind of redundant with photo streams. So personally, when I had iCloud Photo Library turned on, I did not use the photo stream functionality because by its very nature, iCloud Photo Library is going to upload anything that you have on your device or in your photo library. So when you snap a picture, it'll be in the camera roll. It will automatically get pushed into your iCloud Photo Library. So you can keep those things managed separately. And I think you also asked about backups. You know, when you turn on iCloud backups, you know, how can you manage that stuff? You really can't manage that stuff in terms of specifically what gets backed up or what doesn't. Apple kind of defines what that is. Developers define what that is for their applications. And that's just the stuff that gets backed up. Now, as a side question, I think you also asked about managing just what gets backed up in terms of the photo functionality. And it seems like a lot of your questions are surrounding photos. And specifically, you know, if you're using iCloud Photo Library, or what's the advantage of using iCloud Photo Library versus something like Dropbox to back up your photos? And I think it's important to remember that iCloud Photo Library isn't really defined by Apple as a backup solution. That's not the idea. It's more meant to be a copy of your library that's in the cloud, and that every device that you connect to iCloud Photo Library has access to. I really wouldn't consider that a backup. A backup should be the backup of your main system photo library. That's the one when you set up iCloud Photo Library, you say, okay, this is the master library. This is the thing that everything is going to sync off of. Typically, it's the library on your Mac. And for other services like Dropbox or say Flickr, those have apps and the ability to take anything that is on your iPhone and also upload that into one of those services. I would consider the Dropbox one acting more like a backup service, but still, I really see backup as something like my super duper clone or my archive of my iPhoto library that's made via ChronoSync, or the archive of that library that's pushed up into an online backup service like CrashPlan. That sort of thing is really a backup. And I would really consider keeping those things separately. Now, as far as just having a centralized library that all of your iOS devices have access to, I think you could choose between something like iCloud Photo Library or Flickr or Dropbox as that repository. I think as far as accessing the photos, an app like Flickr on your iOS device or the Photos app with iCloud Photo Library on your iOS device, I think that's a more natural way to access those photos. With Dropbox, it's more like browsing through a directory of images. It's not really a photo library management application. So the experience is a little bit different, but you know, the net result is pretty much the same. So that's really just kind of a choice of how you want to access your photos when you're on your mobile devices and have those sync up through the cloud and things like that. I was very happy with iCloud Photo Library when I was using it. Most recently, the only problem I had was when I transitioned from OS X Yosemite to OS X El Capitan. And getting everything to sync back up. And I still haven't resolved that issue. And I'm working on it. Essentially, what I did is I just turned off iCloud Photo Library. I'm waiting for the whole thing to delete, and I'm going to start the process over. But I think I only ran into that problem, if you heard the episode, because I did a clean install and I manually migrated my photo libraries all back over. Had I just done a natural upgrade transition from Yosemite to El Capitan, I don't think I would have run into that issue. And I think your last question was around buying storage from Apple. Do you recommend purchasing the Apple iCloud storage so as to have seamless integration all in one place? And I can just say from my own experience, I personally bought and really like having the extra space and storage space. And I absolutely love the fact that everything is all in one service. It's integrated with my Mac. It's integrated with my iOS devices. I think if you're fully invested in the Apple iCloud ecosystem and you can make it work for you, it is a great way to go. And I think with the latest pricing and a lot of the features, Apple's getting a little bit better with their iCloud services. And really, if you're heavily invested in the Apple ecosystem, I think it benefits you. I think if you can put everything into iCloud, a lot of apps sync with that and work with that, it makes less and less sense to use a third-party service. Now, that being said, I still love Dropbox, and I use that for a lot of various things. And it goes on an application-by-application basis. But I have both of them. I will tell you, though, I buy extra storage from Apple. I don't from Dropbox, although I did get a lot of free Dropbox storage in the early days. So I have a little more storage out of the box than most people would get with a free account. So I don't know if that really answers that question, but I do think if you have everything in iCloud, it's worth buying extra storage if you need it, if you discover you need it. And what's great is you can have it grow with you. So start with the 5 gigabytes, see if that gets you through with the kinds of things that you've turned on and the services that you're accessing. And then if it doesn't, you can always add more and pay your way up. So that's how I would handle it. Okay, we as Mac users, we all hate beach balls, right? And I'm not talking about, you know, the things you throw around at the beach for fun. I'm talking about the thing that makes you wait and wait, that little spinning ball that will pop up and just becomes completely frustrating. And often we have no idea why that thing is there. And we even have, because of the spinning beach ball, the now infamous, what Merlin Mann called, rubber chicken waving dances. And we've talked about it for years on the MacCast. It's, you know, trying to exorcise the demons, the spinning beach ball demon off of our system. And it's things like repair permissions, although we don't have to do that one anymore in El Capitan, right? Zapping the PRAM, clearing our caches, rotating the log files, toggling this setting and that setting, turning off iCloud, turning it back on, all of this voodoo that often works and things maybe get better for a little while, but we never really know what was the root cause. Why was I getting that beach ball? I know I fixed it by doing this little dance and, you know, praying to the Steve Jobs gods, but what happened in the first place? Well, what if I told you there was a magical place, a sort of fountain of knowledge that can reveal all the mysteries of the beach ball to you? And what if I told you that this place is not mythological, but is real? And if you want to go there and see it for yourself right now, all you have to do is open up console app. Wait, where are you going? Why are you running away? You don't have to be afraid of console app. Wait, come back. Okay. Wait, seriously. In all seriousness, okay? I've talked about the console in the past. I bring this up. If you've emailed me, you might even hear me say, have you checked the console? And often the response that I get is, oh my God, I don't know what that thing means. It is scary. It is daunting. I don't understand all of the technical mumbo jumbo and jargons. No, I'm not going there. And that is something I want to help you get over, because the console is a very valuable troubleshooting tool. And it's one that I think a lot of Mac users don't take advantage of because they open it up and it looks scary. It's all text. It's code gibberish. There's no pretty pictures in there, save for a couple of icons and things like that. And it can be overwhelming and daunting. And the thing is that all you have to know is it's a good place to go in and look for errors and patterns, especially when you're having some trouble. And if you combine that with some simple Google foo, doing some Google searches, it can really lead you down a path to enlightenment, or at least finding the root cause of some of your computer issues. It's a helpful tool and you don't need to be afraid of it. So I wanted to share some tips in sort of taming the console. If you've ever tried to troubleshoot through it and you just don't know where to start, I'm hoping this is going to help you out. So one critical thing to do is when you're having an issue, when you see that beach ball, look up at your clock, just note the time, the date and time that you're having the problem, because you can use this when you're in the console to look for a specific time period, to narrow down that space you need to look at. Because again, you're looking at these log files and they're long and there's tons of entries. They're happening all the time. They're going by really quickly. But you want to make sure you get to the point where, okay, I'm having a beach ball at this point. That's where I want to look. So that is your first tip. Narrow it down to just that. And then also note the app or the service that you might be using at the time that might be giving you trouble. So if it's a networking issue, it's probably something related to airport or Wi-Fi. Those become keywords that you can use to kind of search and narrow down and filter what you're looking for. Or if you happen to be using the calendar app or mail, note that word. I was using mail at 3 o'clock today and suddenly I started getting tons of beach balls. What's going on there? Pop open the console and take a look. And when you're looking in there around that time and then you go up in the search box and you filter by the term, you might still have a lot of stuff in there. Look for keywords. Look for things like crash or error or fatal. Those keywords are going to point to the entries that you might want to actually look at and read through to figure out what's going on. And that can really help you find the error. And I'm not saying that that error is going to tell you anything. You might do all of this and you see some error and it's totally cryptic, right? But what you can do is you just take your cursor, you highlight that error, you hit Command C to copy, you open up Safari, you put your cursor in the search box, Command V to paste, and hit enter. And the internet is an amazing tool, and it will likely find the thing that you're looking for. And if it doesn't come up right away, try surrounding the whole line in double quotes to force Google to look for the entire phrase. And you're probably going to find a website, probably an Apple discussion board where other people are having that issue, and you can start to read through there and maybe narrow down and find out what your problem is. Another good way to find the actual entries that you're looking for in the console is if it's a repeatable error, there is a button in the toolbar that says clear display. So when you first open it up, you're going to see all of this log stuff, right? And it's daunting. Click clear display. It's not going to get rid of the log files, but what it'll do is it'll reset any of the entries that are already in there, and you'll start to see more come in. Don't panic. But then repeat the error, you know, the thing that caused your beach ball or caused your error, and watch the console. And you can see often the entry for the specific thing that's causing your problem come in. It will get logged in there, and then you can, again, use some Google searching to figure that out. And the console on the left-hand side, you'll notice there's a bunch of logs and a bunch of areas to look into. That's another area that can, you know, sometimes overwhelm people. There's really just three main areas, in my opinion, that are helpful when troubleshooting problems. The first is all messages, and this is where I start. That's kind of just everything that's coming in, and couple that with doing some of the filtering and searching that I mentioned, and that's your first place to look. If you don't find anything in there, check out the section called Diagnostic and Usage Messages. And if that doesn't work, then another place to look is system.log, the main system log file. And generally, there's some other logs in there. They're more service specific, and you can poke through those if these other areas you're not finding what you're looking for. But that gets kind of deeper in the weeds, and I think if you're getting into that area, you're probably more of a pro user and you know all of this stuff already. But do that, you know, do the Google searching, and, you know, if it doesn't at first yield results. So if the big long, you know, string that you pasted in there doesn't give you what you're looking for, try looking at the error and just look for key kind of keywords and phrases. Shorten the search a little bit in Google, and sometimes that can help you find what you're looking for. And I can't tell you the number of times that looking in the console has led me down the path to fixing an issue on my Mac, or at least getting me to know that I'm not alone in having this error and it's something that maybe Apple is working on or I need to wait for a bug fix. But it, to me, makes it much more or less stressful, I guess I should say, when I see the beach ball, when I know what's going on, or when I can figure out what's going on and then maybe make a plan of action for dealing with it. So I hope that helps you. And it was just something I wanted to cover because it came up this week as I was answering, you know, emails from you. All right. The last thing that I have for you in this episode is some questions about network attached storage. And specifically, Drobo is a sponsor of the MacCast. And Mark heard me do the Drobo spot last time. And I'm going to reiterate this just because I don't want anybody to miss out on this deal. But this is not an ad for Drobo in this episode. We'll have more of those later, you know, in other episodes. But for this one, I just want to remind you, though, you can get $100 off right now a Drobo. So if, you know, as we talk about these network attached storage solutions, if you decide a Drobo is the one that you want, make sure you use the code CAST100, CAST100, at the Drobo store when you check out, and you can get $100 off a Drobo, a third gen Drobo Mini, or a Drobo 5N. And the 5N is their NAS solution, their network attached storage solution. But Mark was specifically asking about the Drobo 5N versus some other products, some other network-attached storage, multi-drive RAID products that are out on the market, like the Synology disk stations or the QNAPs. And I'll just say right up front, personally, I have only ever owned Drobos, and my Drobos are actually all directly attached. I don't own a Drobo 5N or the network-attached versions, although I do have one of my Drobos connected to an old Mac Mini and set up as a file server, so I can access it over the network, but that's not quite a true network-attached storage solution. A network-attached storage solution is something where you have multiple drives in a system, or in some cases it can just be a single drive, but the point is you have a hard drive or a series of hard drives, a RAID, that's connected to your network, and that device is autonomous on the network. So it has its own operating system, it can run its own applications, it can do all its own stuff, and then it provides network services to you. So those services could be file sharing, they could be media services, they could be, you know, all kinds of different things. And most of these solutions that Mark is asking about, the Drobo 5N and the Synology and things like that, have the ability to install apps on the network attached storage solution to give it added and additional functionality. And while I don't own a Synology, I know people who do. And specifically, I know Dave Hamilton from the Mac Observer and the Mac Geek Gab, and I've talked to him extensively about it. He loves his Synology disk station and speaks very highly of it. But Mark, you had some very specific questions, and I think I can answer them at least to the best of my understanding. And then anybody listening can maybe provide us additional feedback if they're using some of the other solutions and share their thoughts. So hopefully we'll open up this discussion to the community and we'll get some, you know, pretty comprehensive answers over the next week or a couple of weeks. And so on to Mark's questions. And oh, by the way, I'll just point out right up front, Mark told me in his email he's not a quote-unquote geek, so many of my answers and recommendations to you, Mark, are going to keep that in mind, because there are some differences from a technology standpoint between the different solutions. And so one of the first questions was, you know, what are the similarities and differences between, say, a Drobo and a Synology? And I'm going to keep the discussion just between a Drobo and a Synology, but note that I'm using, you know, Synology to represent the other category of network-attached solutions. Drobo kind of took a different approach to RAID and network-attached storage, and that's really where the main difference comes into play. So both solutions are network-attached storage solutions, the Drobo 5N and any of the Synology disk station products. Both of them will take multiple drives, and both of them RAID them together. Now, something to note about the Drobo is Drobo doesn't use a traditional raid system. And I don't want to get into raids necessarily here, but, you know, raid 5, raid 1, raid 0, anybody who's into this technology knows about these things. Drobo doesn't really do that kind of raid. A Synology can, but Synology will also do something called a Synology hybrid raid, which is more of what the kind of raid that Drobo does, which is called Beyond Raid. And the advantage of Synology Hybrid Raid and Drobo Beyond Raid is the ability to mix and match hard drives that are different storage sizes. In a traditional raid, you have to have all of your drives the same storage. So if you put in a, you know, 2 terabyte drive in a raid, a traditional raid in slot 1, you need to have the same thing in, you know, same size in most cases in the other slots. With Drobo's Beyond Raid and Synology's Hybrid Raid, you can take whatever drives you have lying around or ones you want to buy, mix and match, and then as you, you know, expand up, you can swap out, say, a 500 gig drive for a 2 terabyte drive, and the system's not going to complain, and you're not going to have any issues about with it. And that's one of the great advantages of Drobo, and it was one of the things they kind of pioneered, at least as far as I know, in terms of a something using that technology in a consumer product, you know, that wasn't just for geeks and nerds. And in general, I think, you know, that's another advantage of the Drobo is they really made it kind of an appliance. At least my experience has been with it has been that way. It's really a plug and play device. And I've been told that the Synology has some of that, but it tends to be a little more geeky. You want to get in a little more deeper into the technology with Synology, whereas a Drobo is really meant you take it out of the box, you plug it in, you connect some drives, you hook it on the network, and you run a little bit of setup wizard, and you're good to go. And you don't have to mess with it much beyond that. Both solutions have apps, things like Plex servers. Synology has had apps longer than the Drobo, and I think tends to have more geeky options and tends to be a little bit more hackable than the Drobo. But for most of the applications that I think your average user is going to use, I think you're going to find the same apps across both platforms. Plex is probably one of the most common ones that you hear about. I'm sure there's some others. iTunes, you know, being able to serve up your iTunes music, being able to do Time Machine backups. And that was another specific question that Mark had is, can you backup to them with Time Machine, and can you do that from more than one computer? Because obviously, if you have a network-attached storage device and you're using Time Machine over the network, you're going to want to be able to back up all of the Macs that are on your network. And the short answer is yes for both the Drobo 5N and the Synology. I'm not 100% sure how it works on the Synology. I would imagine it's in a similar way to how the problem is solved on the Drobo. On the Drobo, what you do is you set up a dedicated Time Machine share for each Mac that you want to back up over the network. And it's important to know that these shares are a specific amount of storage for Time Machine that's allocated out of the total pool of Drobo storage. And you need one Time Machine storage pool for each Mac that you're going to back up. So keep that in mind because, you know, that storage is not available for other Drobo things once you've defined it as a Time Machine storage share. So if you have, you know, 10 terabytes of data in your Drobo, and keep in mind 10 terabytes doesn't of, you know, drive storage, physical drive storage. So if you pop in 5 2-terabyte drives for a total of 10 terabytes, that doesn't mean you get 10 terabytes because another advantage of a RAID system and a Drobo and a Synology and things like that is that you get data redundancy, meaning that if you have a drive fail, one drive, you're not going to lose all your data because it's I don't want to say striped because that's the wrong term, but it's made redundant across the array of drives that are in there. Again, I don't want to get too technical on this stuff, but just know that you can have a drive fail and you're not going to lose your data. And so there's some overhead in that, and there's some additional system overhead and some other things that factor in. And both systems, Drobo and Synology on their websites, have data calculators. So depending upon how many bays you have available in your storage device and then the size of the hard drives that you're going to put in there, it will calculate and it will tell you how much available storage you get. So just for an example, with a Drobo, if you have 5 2-terabyte drives and a Drobo 5N, you have 10 terabytes of total disk in the drive, but your actual usable storage space is just 7.26 terabytes. So you lose a little bit to that overhead and data redundancy, not too much. And it's going to vary depending upon what kinds of drives you mix and match. It's still, I found, the best to use the same size drives if you can. That seems to minimize the amount of loss that goes into the overhead in any of these systems. But the point is getting back to the whole Time Machine thing, you need to allocate Time Machine storage for each Mac. So if you had 3 Macs on your home network and you wanted 2 terabytes of Time Machine storage for each one of those, and you have 7.2 terabytes available in your Drobo, you're going to be left because you're going to allocate 2 terabytes, and 2 terabytes to Time Machine, 6 terabytes of data. You're only going to have 1.26 terabytes left for other things, say like Plex, if you want to run that on your 5N. So it's just something to think about. And then because I've been mentioning it, and we've talked about it the last couple episodes, and Plex is a, you know, app that's now available on the Apple TV, a lot of you have asked me, what is Plex and how does it fit into my network attached storage solution? I don't really get what this thing is. So I am, again, not a Plex expert, but I can give you the basics of what it is and why you might want to use it and why you might want to use it on your NAS solution. So Plex is media management software. It's 2 pieces. It's a server and it's a client. The server is where you're going to store video and audio files, and the clients are the things that you're going to have installed, say, on your iOS device or on your Android phone or your Windows laptop or your Mac or your Apple TV. They're going to be the things that you use to connect to your Plex server, and you're going to use that to stream and view video and media files that are served up by Plex. I kind of think you can think of it as sort of creating your own mini version of Apple's iTunes data center. So if you've bought movies and shows on iTunes and you've ever streamed them to an iOS device, you can think of the data center and iTunes, you know, in the cloud as the server, and you can think of the video application in the case of your iOS device as the client. So Plex is the same thing. It's just you have a Plex client and a Plex server. And both the Drobo and the Synology can install and run Plex server software. So what you do is you use a web browser. So you install that software, and there's usually just a one button click install on either of the devices to set that up. You install a web browser interface and you go on your Mac, you go into the web browser, you are given an address for the Plex server, you connect to that, log in, and then what you do within Plex is you simply point your Plex server at a media folder that is on your storage device. So it would be your Drobo or your Synology. So you have, you simply copy a full folder full of movies, and they have to be non-DRM'd movies. So they have to be DRM-free. So iTunes purchase content won't work, but you could convert that over. And as long as it's DRM-free, you point the Plex server at that. It will recognize, oh, here is a folder of movie files that I have on my storage drive. It will index those, catalog them, and if you want, it can even pull down metadata, things like the cover art and information about the director and the rating and all that sort of thing, and display that within the Plex client for you. So at that point, you can connect with a client, say Plex running on your Apple TV or Plex running on your iOS device, connect back over your network to your Drobo or your Synology with the Plex server running on it, and you can access and stream that media across your network. You can even access and stream that media across the internet if you would like. Now, if you want to be able to download that content from your Plex server over the internet for offline viewing, that does require that you buy what's called a Plex Pass, and that's a subscription service offered by Plex, and it's $4.99 a month or $39.99 a year, or you can pay $149.99 for a lifetime of Plex Pass. You could still stream over the internet without Plex Pass, but if you want to be able to download on the fly, you need to do that. And one of the advantages of Plex too, running a Plex server, is that it will dynamically and on the fly adjust and re-encode your files, or at least re-encode the files coming across the stream for slower connections or slower devices, older devices. So it'll help save a little bit on bandwidth. But basically, Plex is a, you know, it's a media server that you can connect to either over your local network or over the internet. So I hope that explains it. Obviously, there's a lot more technical stuff to it than that, but that's what it is, and that's why you might want to have it on your NAS server. So I hope, Mark, that that answers the basic questions that you have about network-attached storage and solutions. I think the Drobo and the Synology are both great platforms, and each one has advantages and limitations, and you need to kind of look at what your applications are going to be. I'm obviously a fan of the Drobos. I had them long before they were a sponsor of the MacCast, and I think they're a great product. And again, I haven't really had experience with the Synology, but I hope to someday, and I'll be able to maybe better talk about some of the comparisons. But I would take a look at, you know, what your needs are, figure out what you want to use it for, and how technical you want to get into this stuff, and that can kind of help you decide which solution is right for you. And again, if you use one, either or both of these systems, or even another system that you really like that's a NAS solution, let us know what you think about it and give us some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode. Before I leave you, I want to take a quick moment and thank a couple of show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label. Also, Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices, along with PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information, details on all of Smile software at smilesoftware.com/maccast. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other products are worth by going to gazelle.com. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. They are at CacheFly.com, and all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. You can find them at backbeatmedia.com. If you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send me an email or audio comment to maccast@gmail.com. You can also leave a voicemail on the listener hotline. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you're on social media and would like to follow me between shows, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast, or you can find us on Google Plus. The Google Plus community is at google.com/plusmaccast, and that is the plus symbol there. That's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.